I basically just think it would be interesting to look at the emergence of a criminal economy.
And also, I'm always amazed that there aren't more profiles of her out there.
This really subversive, strange thing, in rap especially.
And see what their lives are like on both sides of the border.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Now, a well-made spy movie is completely up my alley, and that's despite the very best efforts of my old friend and colleague, Richard Brody. We've been seeing movies together ever since we were in college, when Richard was always dragging me off to see some obscure film set in, I don't know, medieval Japan, or a drama in Sweden, and always, always films by his favorite, Jean-Luc Godard.
Pourquoi vous êtes triste?
Parce que je suis triste.
Cet idiot. Pourquoi tu es triste? C'est mieux quand je dis vous ou tu.
Pareil, je peux pas me passer de toi.
Tu peux très bien.
Oui, mais je veux pas.
Richard Brody's been writing about film for The New Yorker for over a dozen years now, and I sat down with him and our colleague Alexandra Schwartz and some popcorn and some M&Ms, and we talked about the movies that he thinks should be in contention for the top awards this year. It's the alternative Oscars.
The Brodies.
The Brodies.
I think we need a whole new name, the Brodies.
So we're going to get Richard Brody's take on Best Picture of 2017, the movies you should have seen and maybe still can. Richard, it's all yours.
Well, first and foremost, this is the year of Get Out. Get Out is Jordan Peele's first film as director and writer. And it's a horror film of sorts.
Do they know I'm black?
Should they?
You might wanna, you know.
Mom and Dad, my black boyfriend will be coming up this weekend. I just don't want you to be shocked that he's a black man.
A film that uses the tropes of horror films to tell a story of a different kind of horror, namely America's racist horror. It's, in effect, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, that turns into a explosion of the ugliness underlying white liberal wokeness.
Do you smoke in front of my daughter?
I'm gonna quit.
She'd take care of that for you.
How?
Hypnosis.
I'm good, actually.
Now, but Get Out is going to do well at the Oscars, won't it?
I think Get Out is maybe the only movie on your list that also has official Academy approval.
That's exactly right. And as well it should, because, among other things, it's an immensely entertaining film. Jordan Peele is a very funny man. The movie is not a comedy, but it's full of funny things.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, Richard, so what's your next selection for Best Picture nominee?
Meantime, I'm going to have an M&M or two.
Well, number two for me is A Quiet Passion. It's Terence Davis's biopic, the British director, Terence Davis's biopic of Emily Dickinson. Cynthia Nixon stars as Emily Dickinson.
Should we do a clip?
Oh, absolutely.
Do you guard your soul, Emily?
As best as I am able, sir.
And hell? What of hell?
Avoid it if I can. Endure it if I must.
That was irreligious, young lady.
Then I beg God's pardon for my impiety.
Her performance is remarkable. She brings a rhetorical lilt, a kind of bright-eyed energy with a tragic undertone to every element of the movie, to the comedy, to the pain, to the religious elements, to the family drama. But what's extraordinary about her performance goes together with the film itself. It's in part a screwball comedy with lacerating epigrams.
Emily Dickinson was always known as a hilarious figure in American poetry.
Well, what he reveals is that her humor is a kind of bitter satire on the narrowness of New England mores, to which she was painfully subjected, until the movie becomes a tragedy of physical, emotional, and spiritual sufferings.
Perfect.
We're moving on, yeah? Okay. The third movie on your list, Richard, is one I've seen and I also loved, Good Time.
Good Time is a kind of modernist refraction of the New York crime story, directed by the young New York-based directors Josh and Benny Safdie, starring, of all people, Robert Pattinson as a small-time Queens gangster who ropes his developmentally disabled brother into a robbery that goes wrong.
Just keep your head now.
Turn around.
He's all right. We didn't
throw
it.
Whoa, get back here.
What was the gangster movie you wanted me to see a film for him that I missed?
That was it.
Yeah.
Good Time.
Good Time.
Because they were showing it.
It's coming back. It's great.
Yeah.
Excellent. That was my favorite movie last year. And I think Robert Pattinson requested to be in a Safety Brothers movie, right? He had seen a still or something from their previous movie and really wanted to act with them.
Yeah, Robert Pattinson has a very unusual and sophisticated taste in terms of the movies that he wants to appear in.
How so?
Back in 2008, when he was interviewed in the midst of a Twilight junket, he was asked about his favorite films. Number three on his list was Jean-Luc Godard's First Name Carmen, which he cited in French.
That's why you put him on the list.
That's why.
As the biographer of Jean-Luc Godard, that's why you put him on the list.
He has certified good taste.
Your secret is out, Brody. What's your next selection?
Next selection is A Ghost Story. It's directed by David Lowery, and it's a movie that takes its title literally. A young man, played by Casey Affleck, dies in a car accident and comes back as a ghost and re-inhabits the house in which he had lived with his now widow, Rooney Mara.
Forget.
Oh, there's the trail. The trailer's to the right.
Oh, the trailer.
All to the right, number two, to the right.
When I was little, we used to move all the time. I would write these notes, and I would fold them up really small, and I would hide them.
It does seem like kind of an inspired idea to have the ghost be just a sheet, like in an elementary school play or something. There's something very beautiful about that.
It is very beautiful, and what he does with it is kind of amazing. Ghost Story is a beautiful, delicate film. Lowry takes this almost cartoonish conceit and turns it into something graceful, choreographic. It's mildly comedic, but it's intensely romantic, tender, and metaphysically exquisite.
I'm going to make a confession. I saw the trailer to this, and it didn't appeal. Was the trailer particularly off, or was I particularly off?
No,
both are possible.
No, many trailers are off, because they take usually what's most unusual about a film and eliminate it.
Yeah. I think we've got one more film on your list.
My final selection is a French film called Slack Bay. It's by the director Bruno Dumont, and it's a really compound film. It's set around 1910. It involves aristocrats and mussel harvesters in a seaside resort.
Not weightlifters, but actual mussel harvesters.
Actual mussel harvesters.
Different kind of mussel beach.
Who also happen to be cannibals.
Quel bonheur à chaque fois de retourner sur cette côte. Oui, regardez là-bas, c'est cueilleur de moules.
Interesting. That's a lot of elements.
Oh, there are more elements. There's a romance between the children of the two families, the son of the mussel harvesters and the daughter of the aristocrats, who may in fact be a boy dressed as a girl, unless she's a girl dressed as a boy.
It's amazing that this film did not get widespread support at the Academy. So, Richard, imagine I'm making a drum roll. Who's going to win in the Brody Awards? Who should?
Who should? Get Out. Get Out should win. Get Out is a visionary film. It's not just a film of political fervor. It's also a film of true cinematic vision. Jordan Peele does something that very few first-time directors manage to do. He directs every moment. His control of tone is exquisite. He turns this film into the American equivalent of a Buñuel film, where with point of view, with sardonic angles, with close-ups, with performances, he conjures the inner life of his protagonist. And that inner life is a very grim place.
Richard, earlier you wrote a post on NewYorker.com saying that, in fact, the Academy Awards this time around, nominations, are all over the place. You've got low-budget films, high-budget films. If I can extract from that, I think it's obvious to say that the world of streaming has influenced, and maybe the death of theaters or a lot of theaters is influencing the way things are going. Are you getting a little warmer and fuzzier about the Academy than you used to?
The Academy is reflecting changes in the industry overall, which is to say that there used to be essentially one Hollywood, and now there are multiple Hollywoods. There's the ultra-big-budget Hollywood of superhero movies. But that's not, and that's what makes money, but that's not how the studios want to see themselves. Studios want to see themselves in terms of humanistic, progressive productions. And those movies are no longer being made by studios. They're being made on lower budgets by independent producers with people who work or have worked in Hollywood. In effect, off-Hollywood movies. And that's the kind of movie that, by and large, gets nominated for Oscars.
So I just want to know, of the films that are on the Academy's list for Best Picture, what do you approve of, for example?
Well, there are a couple of films that I think very highly of. Greta Gerwig's Lady Bird. which is a magnificently written and acted film, a vigorously directed film, which at moments has absolute flashes of illumination, of transfiguration.
And it's also an historic moment, right? Because I think that Greta Gerwig is, what, the fifth woman to be ever nominated for Best Director?
Exactly.
And does she have a chance?
I think she does have a chance, and deservedly. Paul Thomas Anderson's film Phantom Thread is one of the best movies of the year.
It doesn't have a chance for Best Picture.
Doesn't have a chance.
Why does it not have a chance? I ask this in ignorance. I would like to see it have a chance.
It'll feel odd. It'll feel slow. I mean, remember who's voting.
Well, the Academy is actually doing a better job of recruiting more active members and a more diverse membership. But ultimately, the Oscars are the movie industry's, Hollywood's, image of itself. And that image is the kind of image that Gene Kelly puts forth at the very beginning of Singin' in the Rain. Dignity, always dignity. And that's why a movie like Phantom Thread, which is really emotionally violent and emotionally eccentric, or a movie like Get Out, which challenges Hollywood's own progressive image of itself,
and
are not likely to win.
What's going to win?
I think that the Shape of Water is going to win.
Why?
The Shape of Water is a romance between two different kinds of beings. In this case, a woman and an aquatic creature who resembles the creature from the Black Lagoon. And it's set in the 1950s, where these two creatures are explicitly struggling with prejudices of the time. So on the one hand, it flatters Hollywood's own sense of itself as progressive. And on the other hand, it's fighting the battles of the 1950s, so to speak.
So what would surprise you in this year's Oscars? Is there any chance that something that you love could run away with it?
Well, I think that Lady Bird has a pretty good chance, actually. If it were a regular political election, I would say that The Shape of Water, Lady Bird, and Get Out are going to split votes. And that, in effect, Shape of Water will squeak through because of a certain division between partisans of Get Out and partisans of Lady Bird.
I would love to see Lady Bird win, and I'd love to see Get Out win. I think my own vote would be split between those two.
I agree. And I also think the Golden State Warriors are going to win. Richard, Alex, thank you very much.
David,
thank you.
Thanks, Alex. Thanks very much.
You can check out Richard Brody on film at newyorker.com. He's writing about new and interesting stuff all the time. Alexandra Schwartz writes about books and many other subjects. I'm David Remnick, and we're going to wrap up today by taking a little trip with the novelist Chang Rae Lee, who's published many stories and essays in The New Yorker. He was born in South Korea and grew up in Westchester, New York. And when he was in his 40s, he spent a year in Hawaii on sabbatical. And he's been going back there about once a year ever since. But the place he wanted to take us was not some breathtaking, unspoiled beach. Instead, Chang Rae Lee picked a store called Don Quixote, a big box store on a nondescript intersection in Honolulu.
We lived here for a year, about 10 years ago. This was the closest store to where we lived, and I just thought it was a regular supermarket. But when you come in, you realize, wow, it really is, you know, the entire world here in these aisles.
It's the kind of place that if you went to Hawaii as a tourist, you'd probably never take notice of it.
It's for, you know, the frugal shopper, And that's always the shopper that I'd always been. I'd always shopped with my mother, and we'd come to stores just like this, stores like Caldor's and Corvette's. And for us back then, as immigrants to New York, New York suburbs, you know, every trip was, at least in the beginning, was a kind of discovery of what was here. Not just in the store, of course, but in the land. And in the same way, you know, if you come to Don Quixote, you know, it's a kind of a different sort of welcome to this place. There's so many items here. I can't believe they must have a whole crew of people just trying to figure out how to restock all this stuff. Local Hawaiian products, Hawaiian-made products. You have just your sort of global brands. Then you have a lot of Korean and Japanese origin products. And so, it's interesting just to think about that person deciding on where to source these things, which ones are going to be popular, knowing, of course, their clientele, which is international, tourist, local. And then I think, very basically just neighborhood people. There's a local brand of punch that my daughters like, so I definitely have to pick up some of that. I would normally buy some fresh produce and fish, some sashimi, but I have to go do a couple other errands. I have to pick up my family at the airport, so I don't want to obviously leave raw ahi in the car. we're going over to the punch section, but you stop here and look at this aisle. It has electric shavers, koa cushions, that's koa wood, car fragrances, and again, in Hawaii, car fragrances are huge, maybe because it's hot and kind of muggy. But then look, underneath car fragrances, Japan hair color. And they have hardware type items too. Military grade nylon paracord. I mean, why do you need this gauge of nylon paracord in 9 different colors? And then in the very next aisle, one of my favorite is the Japanese kitchenware. I just like looking through it, imagining what you might put in there. A little oshinko or have your little shoyu dish and of course your noodle dish. But here's my juice. Yeah, paso guava, passion fruit guava. Got some new flavors. I think I'll just stick with that. This is probably my favorite section of the store. You have scallop poke, mussel poke. I love these little white crabs that you eat raw. They're marinated. I go to Whole Foods and I just, with all their prepared foods, I just want to go to sleep. And again, this is not high-end sushi, but it's, it's decent and it's beautiful and it's fresh. I hate going shopping in the places that we normally go shopping because I know what's there. And I think more and more we're running short of places where you can actually go and not know what you're going to get and have that part of the experience. I know that that's what shopping truly is, I suppose, but the ways that stores are now, they preclude discovery. Because we're always supposed to make things these days to sort of maximize our choices, right? We can Yelp everything. We can look through the social media and do the best job possible of getting the absolutely right product, which I think it's completely false. And we don't know what thing will actually make us, give us that little pop of delight and pleasure. So this place invites you to take a chance. Mm-hmm. In fact, you have to.
2408.
There's always an opportunity for a conversation here, which is nice. They recognize that I'm sure lots of people are in a hurry, but in certain places, and Hawaii is one of them, if you're in a hurry, you're going to get in trouble.
The writer Chang Rae Lee at the Don Quixote store in Honolulu. And if you want to know why a giant Asian specialty grocery store in Hawaii calls itself Don Quixote, I can't enlighten you on that one. I'm David Remnick. That's it for the New Yorker Radio Hour. Next time, Jennifer Lawrence on the new thriller Red Sparrow. I hope you'll join us.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Cal Aaliyah, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Sarah Nix, Michael Raphael, Mythili Rao, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Terrence Bernardo, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.